Lydian alcoholic. I want to thank Mark for asking me to share tonight. I want to thank all my friends that I know, Scott and Bill. It's the fellowship of AA is really a great thing. And when I got here, I thought it was the lamest thing in the world. This time of year is kind of a reminder of what it was like for me. So I was studying music at the University of Kentucky, and I was a percussion major, and of course I was drinking like all the time. So I got this church gig playing timpani. So I go out the night before, get really drunk, and I overslept. But damn it, I'm going to make that gig. So I load up the timpani in this van that I got. And the service is, I don't know if you guys have been to an Easter service, but it's like the busiest time of the year. So it's going on, and right in the middle of the service, I'm wheeling two timpanis right down the middle of the aisle while they're talking. And it's just the worst thing ever. And I still think about it and just cringe. But today, like, I play at a church, and I don't drink, and I show up on time, and I play the music, and it works out really well. So anyway, I'll tell you a little bit what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So I grew up in Kentucky, and my real name isn't Lydian Tone. My real name is Robert Plunkett. I came out here to be a rock star. It didn't work out too well. I changed my name. But I always never felt comfortable being me. I don't know what it was. My mom got divorced when I was 2 years old, and she married a man by the name of Pennington. And then she started having kids. And so her last name was Pennington. My stepfather's last name was Pennington. And all the kids, I have four stepbrothers and two stepsisters, and their all last name was Pennington. And I was the only one in that family with the last name Plunkett. So I felt different right out of the bat. I didn't feel like I fit into that family. I felt uncomfortable. You know, I didn't know why my dad left, you know, and all these things. So that's kind of the way I was when I was growing up. And but when I found alcohol, I didn't worry about what... What my last name? You could call me anything. And I really didn't really care that much, you know. But I was raised part of the time by my great-grandmother, and she had a redneck honky-tonk bar and in Kentucky. And I loved going into that place. She had a jukebox, and I'd love going, seeing those records spin around and listening to the music in there. And they had a bandstand, and they had drums set up there, and a bass. I think it was an upright bass, so they didn't have to plug it in. So, and by the way, I want to thank my friend Oscar for coming out, man. It was like a last-minute thing, and he jumped on it. And we go to Wednesday night together, and then we go to a Friday night meeting in Burbank. He's a good dude, and I just really appreciate you coming out. We had a meeting in the car on the way up, so I really don't have a lot to say. But we kind of said it all. But anyway, I was growing up in Kentucky, raised part of the time by my great-grandmother. She introduced me to music, and she bought me my first drum kit. And so I started playing drums, and I was also playing baseball. I thought I was going to be a baseball player. I was on a little league team that almost went to the Little League World Series. We went 3 games from going there. And we got beat by Florida, and they ended up getting beat by Taiwan. But that's what I thought I was going to do. And I started playing drums at the same time. And, I don't remember my first drink, but I remember the first time I smoked pot. The first time I smoked pot, I laughed so hard my jaws hurt. And but any time I smoked pot after that, it made me paranoid. I felt like people could read my mind. So I stopped smoking that crap. But, alcohol never made me feel like that, you know? I mean, I could drink and be in a bar with people that I didn't know, and I could be friends with everybody by the end of the night, you know? And so I started drinking and started playing music. And I thought I found exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to play music. I wanted to get loaded all the time. I wanted to be rich and famous and die young. So I kind of set out to do that. And what happened for me was like I was telling Oscar on the way up here, he had backyard parties out here, and what we had in Kentucky were field parties. So what we would do is you'd get a hay wagon and go out to the country, get a lot of kegs of beer and a generator, and the band would set up on the hay wagon, and we'd have a big party. And we would do that on the weekends, and we'd come back to school on Monday, and then we'd try to find out where the next party was. And I have a lot of friends back there that did that, and a lot of them aren't alcoholic, but I am. And we all did the same thing. And the only thing that I can think of is that alcohol does something to me that it didn't do with them. And like I told you, what happened for me was, I had this different last name. That was one example of what alcohol did for me. When I drank, I didn't care. And it did something to me. It made me feel good. It made me feel like I fit in with people. And it took away a lot of anxiety that I had. Now, I didn't know that at the time. I just knew that when I took a drink, I felt good. And I wanted more of that, So, I was growing up, going to high school. I started hanging around with people that hung out at what was called the shelter. That's where everybody went that smoked and drank. And I stopped hanging around my friends that played sports. And that was kind of a real decisive period in my life. Then what happened was one summer, a friend of mine goes, so we had graduated high school. And he goes, so what are you going to do? I go, I don't know. He goes, well, I'm going to go down to the college. Do you want to go to the college and join college? And I go, I guess, okay. And 30 minutes later, I'm in college. Now, I have two adult children, and I put them through college. And it took, like, months to get them into college. But back then, it was like, okay, let's go. And I went down there, and now I'm in college. So I started studying music, and things started getting a little weird for me when I joined college. I got a little job down in downtown Lexington, Kentucky, which is where I'm from. It was a movie theater called the Kentucky Theater. It was an Art Deco theater on one side, and they showed art movies, and on the other side, they showed porno movies. And so the employees would work at both places. So I would work down there, and I'd start meeting really interesting people. I remember this one drag queen came up to me and said, "Hey, I saw you on a TV show playing drums." And at the time, I was playing drums in a high school jazz band. And he goes, "I think there's a band in town that's looking for a drummer. They're called the Thrusters, and I think you'd fit in with them." So I auditioned for the band, and I got the job, and it was a punk transvestite band in Kentucky, and I ended up shaving my eyebrows off and dyeing my hair blue-black and playing drums in this band wearing a jock strap. And we played at this place called Club Agogo, and it was a bar that was owned by the lead singer. His parents had died when he was really young, and they left him a trailer park and a bar. And so we became the house band there, and we started, we'd get paid with beer, which was fine with me. And it was during the punk movement, so, we'd have bands like DOA, the Dead Boys, Divine performed there. I mean, it was like, for Kentucky, it was like a really hot spot. But there was a downside to that, too. It was at a time when things weren't really politically correct to do things like that. And we would have people come by with shotguns and shoot out the window, and people would get beat up. And but you know what? On some level, I really, really enjoyed that. It just got me going. It made me feel different than them. And it just, it kind of fueled my alcoholism. So part of my problem with drinking is, you know, it made me feel really good. And I was starting to get into trouble with alcohol. What would happen, when I was around 17 or 18, I started shooting secondhands and Percodans. And I got busted by my uncle, who was a policeman. And I had to live with him for a while. So, and then what happened was I stopped for a little while. I'd stopped using everything because I was living with a policeman, right? And then when I got home from living with him, and I went back with my mother, I started hanging around my friends again. And as soon as I started hanging around my friends, I started using again. Now, the problem with me is that I can stop for a little while drinking, but I always get this thing inside my head that says, maybe I can just have one drink, or maybe I was just being too hard on myself. Maybe I just shouldn't use drugs and just stick to drinking, you know, and then I'd be right back where I was, you know. And the book talks about that. It talks about this peculiar mental twist that we have. And the only thing that can save us from that is a conscious contact with a higher power. Now, when I got here, I wasn't really sure how that was going to work because I didn't believe in God. And I really thought that I was God. I thought if something didn't happen, it was because I didn't make it happen, you know? So I wasn't really sure how this thing was going to work out. And I'll tell you about how I worked through that a little bit later. But I'll give you another example of that insanity. And the insanity that it talks about in the second step, to me, the insanity for me is that I've always gotten into trouble drinking, but then I always took another drink, you know, even though I knew that I shouldn't do that. That for me is the insanity that God restores me from, you know. So what happened for me was studying composition at the University of Kentucky. I got this idea to write a ballet and for chamber orchestra. And I thought it would be a good idea for me to take ballet lessons to learn how to write for that medium. So I did that. And then I also thought it would be a really good idea if I stopped drinking and using drugs so that I could actually do this. So I did that. And I started writing the music. And it was back in the day before computers, so I had to handwrite all the parts, the whole score, and it was, you know, it was crazy. I look back now and I still can't believe I did it. But what happened for me was during the course of that, I got this idea to kill myself. And I don't know where it happened or why it came up, but it just did. So I drank a lot of alcohol, I used a lot of drugs, and I ended up at the psychiatric ward at the University of Kentucky in a ballet outfit and in a straitjacket. And I didn't know how I got there. And if you're new, how I got there was I went into a blackout. And if you don't know what a blackout is when you drink a lot of alcohol and then you're still functioning and then all of a sudden you wake up somewhere and you don't know how in the hell you got there. And that's what happened for me. Now, when I came out to L.A., I found the cure for that, and that was cocaine. When I did cocaine, I never blacked out. And I could stay up for days on that stuff and drink, you know. But so what happened was I was locked up in the psychiatric ward in a straitjacket. And I just told him, I said, hey, look, I don't have a mental problem. I just drank a little bit too much. I'm really, really okay. So they released me. And the very first thing that I did when I got out was I picked up a drink. Now, a normal person would look at that situation and they would go, no, wait a minute, you almost killed yourself and you got locked up in the psychiatric ward for drinking. And the very first thing you're going to do is, when you get out, is drink. That to me is the insanity of alcohol. And that is the mental problem that I have, that I still have today. You know, I mean, my life is really good. I was talking to Oscar about this on the way up. And it's, I'm still like thinking, oh, my life would be a lot better if I just didn't go to meetings, you know? And meetings are the thing that gave me that good life, you know? So I still take contrary action today, you know? I still take contrary action. I think it's the best thing for me, you know? Because my head is broken, and on my own, I'm making bad decisions all the time. I'm making goofy decisions. So anyway, what happened for me was I hooked up with a lady who was a groupie in that punk transvestite band. We're still together. And we decided to move to L.A. And she wanted to be a writer. Well, actually, we're thinking of L.A. or New York. And we figured that L.A. would be easier to struggle in because it was warmer, you know. So we came out here. And I wanted to, like I said, I wanted to be in the music business. She wanted to be a writer. She ended up getting a gig with a little glossy throwaway called Beverly Hills 213. And she was interviewing these stars and everything. And I was working at a liquor store at Sunset in La Cienega. And I just, like I said, things started changing for me when I moved to L.A. I hooked up with a Peruvian Indian who was my cocaine dealer in Laurel Canyon. He was living in a garage with no running water or electricity. And we would get up there and get loaded and talk about the aliens and all this other stuff, man. And what happened was I was doing things like this. I would take a drink on Friday, and I wouldn't come home until Monday. And I wouldn't tell my wife where I was going. And we started doing this little dance where she would take off her wedding ring and say, look, you need to get help or I'm leaving you. And I didn't, you know, like, I didn't do that when I was in Kentucky. You know, I just never did that. So I knew that I had a problem with cocaine. I knew that I had a problem with that. So I would stop doing that, but I would keep drinking. And what would happen for me is drinking would change my perception of my cocaine problem. And I would take a drink and I'd go, I think I could probably do a line, you know? And then Monday would roll around again, man. And it was just like, I was just on this cycle. And it was horrendous, you know? And like, I would be lying to my wife and she'd go, you've been out drinking. It's like, no, I haven't. I'd been gone for 2 days and I'm telling her I hadn't been drinking and I'm like reeking of alcohol. I mean, just lying and just doing god-awful things. So anyway, what happened for me, my bottom, is that she was 3 months pregnant and the baby died inside of her and she wanted me to come to the hospital while they took the baby out. And I was on another run and I couldn't do it. And the reason why I couldn't do it is because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and I don't think about anybody but me. And she's heard me say this before. She could have been dying in that hospital and I wouldn't have shown up. And but I'm not like that today. I would do anything for her. I would do anything for my kids. I'd give my life for them and my grandkids, you know. But back then, man, I was thinking about nobody but me. And I just, you know, so I came home. She came home from the hospital, and she goes, "Look, I think I'm. This is it. I'm done. You know, I've had it." And the only thing that I could think of was that I knew one guy from Kentucky that was going to AA, and he was sober, and I didn't know what AA was about really. So I thought I told her. I said, "Look, I'll call Todd. Maybe he can help me." You know. And I was really desperate because I was just this goofy little kid from Kentucky. The only thing that I knew how to do was play drums. And actually, you know, she tells me to tell you this story. I don't know why, but I don't know how in the hell it could help anybody. But when I came out here, I actually did get a band together. I learned this flame dance from the 65-year-old black drag queen named Toni LaFlame. And I came out here, and I was a lead singer in this band, and I would rip off this paper dress and do this flame dance thinking that I was going to be the next big thing. And I just kept getting weirder and weirder. I mean, and she would, you know, she would defend me, but then she'd get home, and we'd get home, and she'd go, "What in the hell are you doing?" You know? And I just didn't know. So anyway, I didn't have any tools for living at all. I would make my paycheck at the liquor store. I'd give it to her. She'd put it in her bank account. She paid the rent. The car was in her name. The credit card was in her name. I had no tools for living at all. And I knew if she left me, I was screwed. I knew that I would be homeless. And I just, that was the motivation for me. I was just desperate. And plus, you know, when this happened, this was Mother's Day that the baby died. And I really wanted that kid, you know, and for me to turn my back on her and for a potential child of mine is just, today, it's unbelievable how selfish I was. So anyway, I called up Todd. He started taking me to meetings. And like I told you, I didn't want to be in AA. I knew I needed help, but I came out here to be a rock star, not to be an AA. And it looked a lot like church. And I hated Christians. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. And but what, like I told you, my saving grace has been contrary action. So I started going to AA. They told me to show up early. Now, if I, you know, if you don't want to be an AA, why would you show up early? But I did it anyway. They told me to get a sponsor, and a sponsor is somebody that takes you through the steps and help you with trying to stay sober. And I thought that my sponsor would be somebody like my stepdad. And at the time, I hated him. I could not stand him. And I never called him dad or anything like that. And since then, I've made amends with him, and I call him dad. He's the only father that I've ever had. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been able to establish that relationship. But so I got a sponsor anyway, even though I didn't want to do that. And they told me to get commitments at my meetings. And if you don't know what a commitment is like a little job that you do. And the group that I belong to, they're pretty serious about that. So I would get a commitment. Sometimes I'd show up, sometimes I wouldn't, you know, because that's the way I operate. I was totally flaky. Now, what they do at my group is if you don't show up, they fire you off of that commitment. And so what I would do is I'd get a commitment, I'd sometimes show up, they'd fire me off of it, I'd get another commitment. And now I can safely say that I do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it. And that's all because of commitments. And commitments have been so important for me in my job because I have a boss that has deadlines and he wants that job done at a certain time. And the way I've been able to show up and do that is because of taking commitments here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that I've been running my life all my life and getting the same crappy results. But it wasn't until I listened to somebody else's ideas about my life and I started doing those things that my life started changing for the better. And I'm just so grateful for that. You know, I just... But I still had this feeling of like, I remember the first time I started praying, I just felt so lame. I go, I cannot believe that my life has come to this. You know, I'm like on my knees praying. I've never done that, you know. And I think what it is is that I think every step has this built-in humility to it, you know. And it just forces me to give up my ego and my way of doing things just a little bit. You know, like coming to the meeting and raising my hand as an alcoholic. I didn't want to do that, you know. And then, you know, getting on my knees and turning my will and life over to the care of God that I didn't even believe in, you know, and doing that, you know, that is also humbling. Now, the way I handled the God thing in the beginning was I made my sponsor and I made my home group my higher power. So it's like they told me something to do. I believed that that was God speaking through them to me, and I needed to do that. You know, sponsorship has been so important for me. I've been sober a little over 35 years, and I still call my sponsor on a daily basis. I check in with him. I still have commitments at my meeting, and I still do the things that I do, you know, that I did in the beginning, you know, because I don't know. My life is good, and it's because of those things. I know for a fact. So anyway, I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, my journey with God, what happened for me was I did something that was really important, I thought. I started, like at around 7 years, I got really honest about the God thing. I started telling people, I go, look, I've just been doing what you guys tell me to do, you know. You told me to make up a God of my own understanding. And that's been really a great blessing for me, because if it wasn't for that, I don't know if I could make it here, you know. They told me it could be anything that I wanted. It could be anything that I didn't want. It didn't have to be Jesus. It didn't have to be Buddha. It didn't have to be Muhammad. It didn't have to be any of those things. It could be a God of my own understanding. So like I said in the beginning, I made up this, you know, my higher powers, my sponsor, my home group. And but then I started telling people that, you know, I'm just pretending like I believe in God. That's what you told me to do, and that's what I'm doing. Because I started getting into trouble. What happened was I was making a little bit of money. I started working in post-production sound, and but I was living way above my means. And I would get these obsessions to buy things. And the only way I could satisfy that obsession is to go out and buy the thing that I was obsessed about. And then that would fix it for a little while. And then I'd get another obsession. So I got this obsession to buy the Suburban truck. And on the way home from driving it back, I said, I think I have a problem. And what happened for me was I go, what if I get the obsession to drink again? Will I have to drink to satisfy that obsession? And I didn't want to do that because my life at this point was really, really good. And the only thing that I could think of was to go through the steps again. So I asked this guy named Clint Hodges to take me through the steps. And as a result of doing that, I had a spiritual awakening. And it was really, really simple, you know. I mean, he told me to say this prayer. It was like the set-aside prayer. And I would say it, and I'd come back to him, and I'd say, Clint, you know, I've been saying these prayers, and it just doesn't seem like anything's happening. You know, it feels like I'm talking to the wind. It, you know, I really need some kind of concrete proof, you know. And for me, the whole thing about establishing a relationship with God isn't concrete proof. Even though I see it right in front of my eyes here, most of the people in here should be dead, and they're not. And, but, you know, for me, to establish a relationship with a higher power has been searching. I had to search for a higher power and not know. You know, like I wanted to know. I wanted to know. I wanted proof. I wanted hard evidence that God exists. But all I had to do was search. That's all I had to do. And as a result of that, I started getting that, that experience. And what happened for me, look, and I'll read it from the big book because I hear people share from the, about the book, about readings in there. And I go, I don't remember that being in there. But what happened for me was I would tell Clint, I go, hey, I'm going to these meetings. I feel, you know, when I go to the meetings, I feel comfortable. I feel safe. I feel at peace. And I think that everything is going to be okay. And when I leave here driving down to Burbank with Oscar, I'm going to feel the same thing. I guarantee it. And he goes, oh, you know, your meetings are kind of like Bill's cathedral experience. And if you remember, like in the book, he talks about going, he's in war and he goes to Winchester Cathedral and he goes, he was much moved and then he wandered outside. And then he doesn't really talk about that until later. But when he does, he goes, the real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. Now, what happened for me was this. On the way home from visiting Clint, going through the steps, I had this moment of peace, and I didn't know what it was. I've had that moment before. And I just related it to that reading. I go, I've had this feeling before a lot where I felt like I was going to be okay and I'm at peace. And then I would get the obsession to drink, or I'd be worried about paying bills, or I'd be fill in the blank, whatever problems I have. And then I would forget that little feeling. So I wanted to hang on to that. When I got home, I wanted to hang on to it because I think something happened to me. And I called Clint and I said, Clint, I think something happened to me. I think I've had a shift. And before I could say another word, he goes, yeah, when it happened to me, I was at a convention and I would keep going back to my hotel room and I would say, are you with me? And I had that same feeling. I had this feeling just come over me and I wanted it to stay with me. So I felt like I was onto something. So ever since then, I've been trying to keep that presence and that feeling, which I call peace. And I have a lot of tools for dealing with that. All the prayers that I know are from this big book. And it seems to me that most of them are geared towards one thing, getting to some kind of state of peacefulness. You know, the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. St. Francis, make me a channel of your peace. You know, the Lord's Prayer, you know. So I felt like I was onto something, and I just wanted to hang on to that. Now, the thing about this is that I thought having the spiritual awakening was kind of like winning the lottery, you know. I thought everything was going to be perfect, you know. I didn't think I would have any problems. But I was going through, I had my own business. It was failing miserably. I'd lost a house, and I was late on car payments and everything. And what would happen, even after I had this experience, I would have a creditor call, and I knew exactly what they wanted, and I didn't have it. You know, I didn't have the money. And I would hang up on them. And one day I did that to one of these creditors, and I walked out, and my car was gone. And what happened was they repossessed it. And I called up Clint. I said, you know, what the hell's going on? You know, I had this spiritual awakening, and this happens. And really, the truth is that I should have talked to those people and let them know what was going on. But that, it just kind of shows you that you can have this experience and still be goofy and think that you're onto something and still make big mistakes. And Clint was so kind with me. He said, look, all you have to do is when you get off the path, just get back on the path. And that's what I've been doing, is that I've just been trying to get back on the path anytime I get off. And I have tools to do that, like I said. Oscar and I go to this Friday meeting, and it's a 12 and 12, where we go through the 12 and 12 every week. And you know, in there, they talk about emotional sobriety. And I've heard people talk about that from the podium. And what I thought was that this person is probably seeing a psychiatrist, and we're hearing some of his psychiatrist talk, you know. And then when I started going to this 12 and 12, it was like Bill Wilson was writing about emotional sobriety. And I didn't know what that was, but I was experiencing emotional benders all the time. And I kind of went through one a little bit yesterday. I had a cello lesson booked at 11 o'clock. And before that, I had told a guy in my group that I would help him with the sound with Johnny Harris's memorial. And the first thing I did was I freaked out and I go, I double booked, I can't make it. And then I started looking at my life again. And I go, look, I made that commitment first, and that's what I'm going to do. I called up my cello teacher and I said, look, I can't make it. I have another plan. He said, no worries. Don't worry about it. And also I had the whole day planned because I had a bunch of, me and my wife had downsized. We moved out of our house and moved into a smaller unit. And so I had a bunch of yard work that I was going to do, and it was raining like hell. So, and all this time I've been doing what it talks about upon awakening. You know, I pray every day, God, I'm no longer running the show. Thy will, not mine, be done. You know, because I always try to organize life to suit myself. And when it doesn't happen that way, I get bent out of shape. And that for me is an emotional bender. And I need to know how to get out of that, because those are the things that make me drink. And, you know, like I would get into fights with my wife sometimes. And that's another emotional bender. And for some reason, I get off on that adrenaline rush. I know exactly if I say something after she's said something that we will be into it. If I could just keep my mouth shut long enough, it blows over and I'm back in that peaceful state. And I don't have to make an amends. I don't have to call my sponsor and say, oh my God, you won't believe what I did. You won't believe what she did, you know, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, the program has just kind of, it just keeps changing for me, you know, and it keeps making my life better. It gives me some serenity, enough serenity where I can actually think about somebody else other than myself and try to pass along to what has been given to me, you know. I remember, you know, when I would meet Clint had his own law office. He had his own law business. And he would meet people on the weekend and take them through the steps. Now, at the time, I was thinking, the weekends are mine. Those are my days. I'm not doing any program stuff. I'm going to enjoy Saturday and Sunday. And here I am going to Clint's on Saturday, and he has a whole line of guys waiting for him, you know, to take them through the steps. And I just can't believe the sacrifice that he made for them and for me. And so that gave me a really good idea what I need to do, you know. So I try to I take people through the steps. I show them how I established a relationship with a higher power. And I try to pass this along to other people. And I've been so blessed to have men in my life, you know. One thing that happened for me was, when I went through the steps, when you go through the steps and do the fourth step, you keep getting you keep writing about the same crap. And I kept writing about, like, the same stuff. Like, I would go to a job, and I thought this was a character asset. I didn't know it was a character defect. But I would go to a job, somebody would get a raise, and it would piss me off. And what I would do is I'd be envious, and it would make me work harder so that I could try to get that and get that much money or whatever. And it would just drive me crazy. Everywhere that I went, I did that, and I would never get what I wanted, you know. And, Clint pointed out something to me in my fourth step. He goes, well, you have a problem with male authority figures in your life. And I go, he probably tells that to everybody he takes through the steps, you know. It's probably like a pat line. But then I started looking at that. I started looking at my relationship with my stepfather. And I have always, always been suspicious about male figures in my life, you know, and never gave them a chance until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I said, I have been blessed with the men in my life. I've been blessed with Clancy, a guy named Byron Wallin. My sponsor is Charlie Carney, Charlie C. Vince Yeo was a big part of my life. Just recently, you know, Johnny Harris, you know, I would look at him from afar, and he was always a great example for me. I'm the man that you guys have made me. Now, if you're new, you're going, I don't even know who you are. What I'm talking about is just showing up here in AA and being a part of this fellowship and just trying to reduce my ego enough so that I can listen to somebody else and see if I could possibly get some peace in my life with some unresolved issues. I'm so grateful for this program. It has changed my life. I remember reading in the Big Book where Bill Wilson would talk about being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. And I didn't have that. And I can safely say that that has come true in my life. My life is way better than anything that I would plan. My wife just recently got Italian citizenship. We're thinking about maybe retiring over there. And never in a million years did I think something like that would happen to me. And I'm currently going back to school to study to get my music degree. My life is so full and so blessed, and it's because of this program. And I hope you find what I found. Thank you.